The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 198.
Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
All right, guys, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to welcome someone back to the Rebel Capitalist Show. He's a very good friend of mine. He has an amazing YouTube channel where he really gets into the nitty-gritty with supplies such as lumber, things that affect our everyday lives. His name is The Uneducated Economist, but in my opinion, I think he's far more educated than a lot of the economists out there. Mr. Economist, welcome to the Rebel Capitalist Show.
Wow, George, thank you so much. I'm glad to be here. That's quite an intro.
Yeah, so hey, can you do me a favor for a lot of my viewers or listeners who might not know your quick backstory and what you do daily? Can you fill us in on that? Because I think that's really important to understand the rest of the conversation.
Sure. So in my day job, I work at a lumber yard doing retail sales. I've been doing that pretty much my entire life. I have worked construction in the past. Pretty much I was working construction during the great financial crisis. I tried to buy a house during that time, lost pretty much everything, went into depression, tried to figure out what was going on, hit the computer, started Googling what a mortgage-backed security was, what credit default swaps were, had no idea about any of this stuff, and just kind of slowly kind of started building up the knowledge, and I just never gave it up. Put 3-4 hours of research in every day to try and come up with content for the channel. And just try to stay up to date on what's going on as far as the economy goes. You know, when I started this channel, I was just trying to create an area that people could have a conversation. And really, I was just trying to find a place that I could talk with friends and family about, you know, kind of give them some ideas of what was taking place. And the channel just really, really grew and people liked the perspective. And now it's up to 47,000 subscribers. I'm just blown away. Never expected it. Never in a million years did I think it would ever
care. Yeah. And I want to let people know that I have spoken with several hedge fund managers that manage a lot of money and they don't really know that I know you well. You know, they have no clue that I know you well. They probably haven't watched any of the videos or anything like that. And, you know, I'll be talking to them on Skype or on the phone and they'll say, listen, if you really want the inside information on lumber prices and housing, you know, the materials that are going into housing, you got to check out this channel. And they're like, oh, it's a small channel. I think the guy's name is The Uneducated Economist. Yeah. Like, of course, I know exactly who he is. But my point is, you got a lot of hedge fund managers watching your channel to get some insider information. It's really fascinating. So that's how fantastic your channel is and why everyone, one of the many reasons why people should subscribe to it.
Yeah. You know, I mean, well, having my fingers on the pulse of the industry for building materials really helps. And then having like this kind of understanding of what's going on in macroeconomics, really, you know, there's not a whole lot of people putting those two together.
Yeah.
And, you know, especially on YouTube. So that's really like, you know, it kind of gave me a little niche area to be in, and yeah, especially from the retail end of things, it really gives a perspective that's different from like, you know, what you would normally get from like, you know, some of the bigger guys out there, you know, who are putting all this analysis together and stuff. I'm just talking about how many phone calls I get. I talk about how, you know, the overall feeling of the contractors are, how their bidding is taking place and stuff. This is things that typical, like, you know, hedge fund guys, they have to wait to get that information. Mm-hmm. You know, they have to hear about it. I'm like right there in the middle of it, dealing with it, talking about it. So yeah, yeah. It gives me a nice niche area to be in.
So tell us about the last year or the last 6-9 months or so in the price of lumber and let us know what it's been doing. But then let's kind of dive into why it's been doing it, because I think if people understand that, they can understand what may happen to not only other commodities, but the prices of goods and services in the future.
Yeah. Lumber has had an incredible story, unlike anything that anybody would have ever anticipated with the price moves that's taken place. Really, like, I mean, we could go on for hours, you know, because the story goes way back. It goes back, you know, many years ago. And if you include some of the trade war tariffs and stuff like that with Canada, the lumber price story can just take back many, many decades. But really, over the last year, maybe even 2 years, there's been some really significant things that have happened with lumber mill curtailments, lumber supply, the trade wars, bugs, fires. I mean, all this stuff has happened in the last couple of years, and it's really done a number to the pricing. But if we just kind of take it back to just what's happened in the last year, basically since March, you know, since last March, when the pandemic first hit and everybody was freaking out about that, they locked down everybody, including buildings, homes, everything stopped. We were even trying to figure out what it is we were going to do with our location here. You know, it's just like, right. Do we cut back hours? Do we cut back man out? I mean, what do we do here? And the mills thought the same thing. Nobody's going to be building, curtailments, inventories, you know, depletion. Everybody was kind of getting ready for this, like, you know, everybody's going to be locked down, not doing anything. Stimulus checks come out, people start buying. So at the same time that there was this huge inventory depletion and the price of lumber, I mean, just to kind of give you an idea on price of lumber at that time, the lumber is priced out in the futures on a per thousand basis. So for every 1,000 board feet, it'll cost a certain hundred amount of dollars. So back in March, it had dropped down all the way down to 250 per thousand. Now, to kind of relate that to a 2x4, like standard embedded, which is the most common piece of lumber you're going to get out there, that takes a 2x4 down to around $2.50 or so. Depends on how long it stays at that 250 per thousand or, you know, stuff like that. But that's ultimately what happens with the retail prices. It brings that down too. So this lockdown takes place during this time when there's a curtailment, inventory depletion. Stimulus checks go out and people are at home wanting to improve their surroundings. They need to work from home. They want to, you know, they're going to be spending summer at home. So they build a new deck. They put a fence up to block the neighbor out. And there was a big demand for wood right then. And it just shot the inventory to depletion. There was nothing left. Mills started firing up to try and fill in the inventory. But once you have a depletion of this level during a time when there all of a sudden starts to be a building increase taking place, because as the lockdowns were coming out, people went back into building, interest rates are really low and people wanted to start building. Everybody's out there buying and there's no supply and the prices right. just shot through the roof. Went all the way up from 250 per thousand, all the way up to 1,000 per thousand by the end of summer.
Wow.
And stores were selling for $8. It was unreal. Unlike anything that anybody had ever anticipated was going to happen. The price of like the average home, from what I understand, to frame an average home increased by $10,000-$15,000. And I can imagine it was probably even more on some of the, you know, higher end homes that use a little bit more material and stuff.
Yeah. Do you know Ken McElroy?
I'm sorry?
Do you know Ken McElroy?
Yeah,
he's on YouTube. He does most of Robert Kiyosaki's investing in real estate. And he and I were at dinner the other night. And we were talking about cost per square foot for new builds, not including the land or the permits, just the construction costs. And I've got something to compare it to, because back in 2013-14, I did a new build in Northeast Portland by Mount Tabor. And so I bought a lot, we subdivided it, and on the new lot, I built a brand new home. It was, I can't recall, maybe 3,000 square feet, something like that. But anyway, my cost to build there, because I was partnering with a GC buddy of mine, was, so minus the GC cost, because he was taking a portion of the profit, it was about $120, $130 a square foot. And I was talking to Ken, because he's in the process right now of building some apartment complexes from scratch. So this would be all apartment grade finishes. And he's saying he's spending between $200 and $240 a foot.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Wow.
So I don't know if that's consistent with what you're hearing from the GCs there locally. But that might, and also to, another thing I want to point out for the listener and the viewer is, notice that what we're talking about is not only the demand side of the equation, but also the supply side.
Yes.
In the comments of my videos and on Twitter, and I'm sure you get this a lot, people, for some reason, they get just hyper-focused on demand. Well, demand is going to crash. You know, the economy is going to crash. There's no more demand. There's no more demand. There's no more demand because the economy is suffering. You know, all these businesses are going bust. I totally get it. And I agree. But the question isn't exclusively, is demand going up or down? The question is, how fast is supply going down or up relative to demand. So if both are going down, but supply is going down faster, which it sounds like kind of what happened back in March and April, you can still see the price of XYZ triple, quadruple. So I just wanted to point that out for the viewers. But anyway, are those the prices that you're seeing per square foot for the new builds?
Well, you know, when it comes to the new builds, I'm not sure exactly what these contractors and what the new price is as far as, you know, compared to the material increase.
Okay.
I'm not exactly sure where they're at on it. I know a lot of contractors have come to me, and you know, I wish I was a little bit more involved in some of the bigger projects. I really don't do that for my company. I am more of the kind of guy who, you know, when you need a special order door, you need windows, you need siding, you need stuff like that. I'm the guy who comes and like searches out all the specialty items for you.
Okay.
You know, that's kind of what I do there. So I'm not directly involved in some of the house packages that go out, although I am like right there. You know, I'm you know, the guys are just like right there, and I talk to them all the time. I'm not exactly sure where the price per foot that the contractors are at on it, or what the framing that they're bidding it out at. I know a lot of guys have gotten burned on these prices because, like, even in November, what was it, November? Yeah, I think it was back in November, the price per thousand actually had a significant drop from that peak. And I thought, okay, here we go. We're going to come into the wintertime, slow down for the building season. You would typically see prices come down. And I thought, okay, well, that was a crazy summer, all-time highs. But then it bounced and it started coming back up again. Mm-hmm. And so now here, I checked it just before we started the video. I think we're back up to 913 per thousand again, which is just like, you know, I mean, it's within sight of the all-time highs again. Why? And if it continues here during this wintertime, like where there was typically a slowdown, and we go into the start of the new season at 1,000 per thousand on the lumber prices, just as demand is starting to pick up, you know, without like, you know, saying something unforeseen happening within the economy to change the way things are going.
Yeah.
Next year's building costs are going to be even more than last year.
You know, it's the famous saying that's so true. And I've heard Jim Rogers say it a million times. The cure for high prices are high prices. So why have these high prices not cured themselves? In other words, why isn't there just a ton more supply coming online to bring the prices back down to something that would be quote unquote normal?
Yeah, you know, and that's kind of an interesting question because I have asked a lot of people about that. And I have a buddy who works here at our local mill, and he says, I don't know, man, we're running full steam. We're pumping out as much lumber as we can.
Hmm.
And I talked to a logging buddy of mine. And he says, yeah, they had a lot of, logging is a really, and I'm still trying to learn how it is that logging happens, because the time that they decide that they're going to cut those trees, so the time it turns into lumber is quite a ways difference.
Right.
And in during the lockdown, there was wood on the ground that has to get cleared. I mean, they have to take it. And there was no demand at the time that this was taking place. So there was kind of an interesting, like, kind of timber glut right there. So like as the lumber started kind of ramping up and getting, you know, kind of moving through the system again, there was like this glut of timber that was going through. I mean, my buddy was telling me, he was like, man, I've never had to sweep the shop before. Yeah. You know, I mean, he's always out in the woods, you know, but he said there was times where there was nothing to do. So he had to sweep, you know, like he was just doing anything around the shop that they could do. And so there was kind of like this weird, like kind of timber glut that took place right there. But I would have assumed that that would have cleared out by now and that things would kind of be going back into normal. You know, one of the other things is that the mills up in Canada were pumping out a lot of lumber a couple of years ago. There's a place called 100 Mile up in the British Columbia area. That's all they have up there. That's it. It's just trees and mills and generations. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's kind of funny to say, but there's nothing. That's all they got. And when that whole like trade war and everything started kicking in, and the United States put this huge tariff on softwoods coming out of Canada, it devastated those mills up there. It killed them. And there was a bunch of shutdowns that took place up there. And I was reading some of the articles about it, and it was quite sad. I mean, these people saying like, you know, I mean, my, you know, my dad worked here, my grandfather worked here, you know, my kids were going to work here. So when those things got shut down, you can't just like, you know, fire it back up and say, okay, let's just start pumping out a bunch more lumber again. I mean, once it's done, you know? Right. And so there was like a supply production issue that had, you know, kind of hit the system back then that really isn't firing back up the way it used to. So I think it was probably more in the fact that there was that wave of shutdowns, that mill curtailments and shutdowns yeah. that take place that really doesn't allow for, you know, the robust system of supply again.
Yeah, man, this is interesting on so many different levels. But in case because it's a micro analysis, but it teaches us so many macro lessons, you know? And so why is this stuff important to the average Joe? Well, first of all, everyone is always trying to figure out what housing prices are going to do. You know, in 2000, you know, if you do a video with that title, if I do a video, I know it's going to do well because people, oh, I'll click on it. You know, what are housing prices going to do? Because everyone either rents or buys. Most people live under a roof, you know, so we're interested in this stuff. And the housing price is going to be determined, or one of the metrics, one of the cross currents is going to be the price to build from scratch. It's going to be how much does it cost you per square foot to build something new or to build what you have? And, you know, when I invested in real estate in 2012, one of the reasons why I got so aggressive is because I was able to buy so much lower on a cost per square foot basis than the cost of construction. So I knew that in order for there to be more supply come online to compete with what I already purchased, the price would have to come up because these builders aren't going to do it at a loss. So my point is, if you're out there looking at a let's say you're in Oregon and it is, let's say, $250 a square foot to build from scratch. Well, if you're buying at $220, you know that there's a delta there. Or on the flip side, if you're buying at $500 a square foot, you know that you've got some significant downside, and maybe there's going to be a builder that's going to come in and build what you have. So that's why this is important. The second reason I think this is really important, and I'd like to get your feedback on this, is when you talked about those lumber mills shutting down, and they're not coming back online. When you fire all your employees, when you run out of money, it's not like you just flip a switch and all of a sudden you're in business again. When the market comes back, you're done. Your savings is depleted. You can't just go get a PPP loan or some sort of stimulus check from the government. But think about how many businesses across the United States are in the exact same situation. And we assume that, oh, you know, you read the headlines, if we get a vaccine or whatever, it's just going to magically come back in 2 weeks and we're going to be off to the races. You hear the CNBC people talk about it in the Bloomberg. Well, they don't understand. There are hundreds of thousands of small and mid-sized businesses that have gone out of business. They're not coming back. So the question we need to ask ourselves, what does that do to the supply side of the equation? Therefore, what does that do to prices of the stuff we buy daily over the long term into the future? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah. You know, I kind of think about like some of the businesses that I know, like I look at what is happening here that I can see and just assume that it's probably happening something similar to that to the rest of the nation out there. Yeah. And
you're on the coast of Oregon, just to be clear.
Yeah. On the coast of Oregon, and I'm also in kind of a touristy town, so you know, we kind of rely on having restaurants and service and hotels, and that's kind of like what our income is here for us.
Yeah.
We do have fishing and logging industry, so we're, you know, somewhat of an industrial town, but not in the sense of like, you know, come visit Astoria and leave your money here, you know. A lot of the people that I know who are running restaurants are just like beside themselves on trying to figure out how it is that they're supposed to run this business. You know, they were under the impression that it was just going to be locked down for a little while. You know, some of them thought it was just like, hey, if we're going to be locked down, let's take this moment, an opportunity to remodel, you know, let's do some, they remodel, get ready to open up, and then they can't open up, you know, they get partial open, you know, and a restaurant profits when it's completely full, not when it's partially open, not when, you know, you have like takeout only orders. although that seems to be the only way they can survive now is with these takeout orders. I mean, why have a whole dining room? Why have all the chairs? Why have all the stuff? I mean, and yeah. So when you think about like what it is to try and build a business up, I mean, if you wanted to have a restaurant, a really successful one, think about all the equipment and things that go into it just to have people to come in and sit down. All that stuff is no longer needed.
Yeah, I guarantee you I've never owned a restaurant, but I would assume that the lease is a real big portion. The lease and payroll, other than your cost of goods sold, is probably the biggest portion of your expenses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've known quite a few restaurant owners, and it can be a very profitable, successful business. The amount of work and stress that they put into doing that, I don't know if it's necessarily worth it. And doing this, I definitely don't think it's worth it, but they still try hard. And every Friday I try to do a takeout from somewhere here local, just to try and support the local
business. What are the regulations or restrictions there now? I think we spoke about 4-5 months ago, something like that. And you're saying that locally they were opening restaurants up, but they only allowed them to do like 50 or 25% capacity. What is it like there now?
They shut it all down again.
Really?
I mean, there's no sit down. And you know what really gets to me is like, and I don't mean to complain about politics or anything like that, but it's really frustrating when you see like, it's okay to have somebody come in and sit down in your restaurant and serve them food and beer or whatever, if you have a poker machine. But if you don't have a poker machine, sorry, you don't get to.
You're kidding me.
I am not kidding you. Right. I haven't read up on that, but that's what one of the owners was just telling me. She goes, man, I didn't get those Pokemon. She was so mad about it because she never got the Pokemon. Anyway, isn't that something?
That poker machines prevent COVID, right?
Is that?
Poker machines prevent COVID. Maybe you didn't know that. You either wear a mask or as long as you have a poker machine next to you, you're totally safe. You probably didn't know that.
I don't know. I got to look up to see what that exactly is. But that's what they were telling me, that if you have poker machines, people can come in and sit down and play the poker.
Yeah, it's just the hypocrisy is staggering. Where do you see this going? I don't know if you've given that much thought. Well, you probably have, just with your business. What are the restrictions with the place where you work? Do they just make them wear masks when they come in, or is that a law that maybe the owner imposed, or how does it work with the business where you work?
Yeah, pretty much everybody here wears masks. The owner requires everybody to wear masks inside the store. We have
Is it by law though, or is that just him?
Okay. I'm not sure about the legalities of it. Like the actual, like, I have never heard of anybody ever getting a ticket or ever having police enforcement.
Okay.
I don't want to say who they are, but there's a business in town that gets quite a bit of traffic on a daily basis. And they tried to enforce masks there. If they call the cops and say something about masks, the cops will not show up. Mm. So they have to use the word trespassing.
Oh, I see.
Cops do anything about it. So ultimately, it is a self-enforced mask rule inside businesses, but everybody is enforcing it. Like okay. You can't walk into a store with that. I'm sorry, sir, you got a mask? You can't do it. It's just
Got it. So where do you see this going long term? I mean, where do you think we'll be in a year? Do you think people will still be wearing masks? Have you put any thought into it?
I have, and I do. I think that, to be honest with you, George, I hate to say it because it sounds so conspiratorial, but the mask issues and COVID issues and all that stuff, regardless of vaccines and everything that's getting put out there, all that stuff is really inconsequential when it comes to when the economy recovers. Once the economy recovers, all this stuff will go away. They won't have anything to worry about needing to blame it on. See, if they didn't have COVID, everybody would have been flipping out and pointing the fingers at politicians and bankers and wanting to hang them. So they didn't create they
smoke and mirrors type thing.
Because it sounds so bad, but they embellished, right? They embellished the story, pushed it out there, got everybody all freaked out about it, and say, "Here's why the economy is failing. It's because of COVID, guys." But the economy was failing far before COVID hit. So, like, everybody who was paying attention was just like, "This COVID thing is BS." You know, I mean, it's not BS in the sense that it isn't real, but it's BS in the sense that it was, that it's the reason that is, you know, the economy deteriorated. No, I mean, it might have like exasperated it, but it didn't, it was already deteriorating, and it's just a perfect excuse not to blame bankers or politicians for it.
Yeah. And it shows you how, oh my gosh, we could go down this rabbit hole, but they're just the misallocation of resources and the malinvestment that's been created since, even I'd go back to 2000 as a result of the Fed and the politicians. It's mind-boggling. And it's not the fault of the individual. It's not the fault of the average Joe. It's not the fault of the entrepreneur. They're just looking at the price signals around them and making rational decisions. And it's just so unfortunate. Yeah, I used the example of a story I saw in Zero Hedge the other day, where this kid was just pissed at these hedge funds with the whole GameStop ordeal. And he was saying that, you know, he's going to be diamond hands. He doesn't care how much money he loses, because he wants to send a message to Wall Street, because going back to the GFC, he was a kid, and his dad, and I don't know what it was, 2004, 2005, saw the demand for housing increase. So he started a concrete company. Well, of course, when everything comes crashing down, the dad loses his concrete company, as well as his life savings, to the point where the kid remembers having to scrounge around for change in the couch to put food on the table and to put gas in the car. Mm-hmm. And that's just, I always use, and I'm sure you do as well, use the term malinvestment. But people are like, yeah, okay, I get it. It sounds like something Hayek would say, or Mises. It doesn't really make a connection. That is malinvestment. Where this gentleman who started the concrete company, he's just looking around him, looking at the price signals. Housing prices are going up. There's a lot of demand for concrete. Therefore, he's going to start a concrete business. He takes his entire life savings. But that's all done as a result of the Fed lowering interest rates and the government coming in and pushing the Community Reinvestment Act and all these other things. It's not based on economic fundamentals. Therefore, it isn't sustainable. So when it all comes crashing down, the malinvestment gets wiped out of the system. But on an individual level, that person, that family, they lose their life savings and they suffer. Yeah. And this is what we're, in my opinion, this is what we're seeing right now in the economy, that the Cervasis sickness, we'll call it, has just exacerbated this problem. But it's just showing us the amount of malinvestment that has been created over the last two decades. I mean, do we really need like 15 food delivery services? Probably not. Yeah. Do we need all these malls and everything? You know, probably not. Well, all those things are a result of artificially low interest rates. I did a thought experiment on a video the other day where I said, okay, what if interest rates never went below 5% on Fed funds? What if the 10-year never went below 7% over the last two decades? How would our world, how would the U.S. economy be different? I mean, would we have Tesla? You know, would we have all of these things? And it's an interesting question. What do you think? Have you ever given that any thought?
I have. And, you know, because that's it. Would we have Tesla? Would we have this really awesome car company out there that nobody would have ever anticipated, like, growing to this kind of level? I mean,
most likely wouldn't have made it without cheap money. So I'm not saying Tesla is good or bad. I'm saying, you know, would we have Uber and Lyft?
Right.
Or would we just have Uber? You know, these companies just burn money. We'll use a company that's a little less emotional than Tesla. You know, would we have that? Or another thing, would we have this whole issue with GameStop? Right? Would these people be pissed off enough at Wall Street? Would you have all these emotions? Would we have pension funds that are investing in WeWork and SoftBank, because on leverage, by the way, because they can't get a 7% return anymore because the 10 years paying 90 basis points? You know, there's so many knock-on effects. It's staggering.
Well, I try and think local and how that applies to some of my macroeconomics, research that I've done. And when it comes to malinvestment, I think probably the best story that I know of is the company that I used to work for. I put videos out on YouTube on another channel talking about the shutdowns of these stores. I was documenting it as it was happening 10 years ago, 12 years ago. And these stores were absolutely beautiful. The guy who built them spared no expense. These things were awesome. They were huge. They had big murals on the walls. The floors had radiant heat in them with stamped concrete that was stained and beautiful and it just looked awesome. Nothing was out of place. There was like clear fur trim everywhere. Just beautiful. I mean, absolutely top-notch stores. Was able to build these things on the low interest rates.
Right.
The borrow money, super cheap, and build this over embellished thing, right? This huge, beautiful grand thing. But then the great financial crisis hits and you can no longer make those payments. Well, the building still exists, right? But he doesn't get to keep all the hard work, all the dedication, all the effort, all the time, everything that he put into it is no longer his, but it does go to somebody. You see, so the low interest rate to me, it's a lot like farming. I just think about it like a farmer would. As the interest rates, like you have the devastation, you have this horrible event, this recession, right? The ground is depleted. Well, now it's time to fertilize. As you start dropping interest rates, you're basically adding water and you're adding fertilizer to the plants that grow. And then when you get the interest rates so low to the point that you can no longer drop them and you have all these grand, beautiful things that everybody built off of the cheap interest rates and you devastate them, bang, they can no longer make the payments. And all those big, beautiful things that are built out there from the people on cheap interest now go to the people who have the cash on hand to buy it on, for pennies on the dollar.
Right.
The way that the rich, I hate to say it like this because it sounds so conspiratorial and I don't like being there, but it's the easiest way to understand it. It's like the rich are farming the people with cheap interest rates so they can take all the beautiful things that they build.
Yeah.
And they just, the recession that hit, and they don't even really have to do it. It just kind of happens on its own because of the way the monetary system is built. You have debt cycles to it. And if you just kind of see that the debt cycle is coming to an end, you need to just go ahead and load up on cash during a time when everybody says cash is trash. And then the thing switches around and you're sitting on all the cash as everybody's in demand for it as they ask them for pennies on dollars on their property.
Yeah, right. Or the investor goes into cash and then you have inflation, then you're losing purchasing power on inflation potentially. It's like there's a no-win situation. I think the only thing the average Joe can do is just to understand what you can buy that doesn't have counterparty risk, such as precious metals, and understand how to build a portfolio so you're not emotional about it. Because that's where people really make mistakes. As human beings, we're hardwired to think emotionally, not really rationally. And that's why most people lose money in the stock market or as day traders or even investors. Most of them that don't just give their money to a passive income or passive fund and in my opinion, kind of get lucky because the Fed has done everything they can to prop up the stock market, which has benefited a lot of those people that just kind of threw something at a passive index fund and closed their eyes. So those people have reaped the benefits. That's fantastic. But I just think that for the average person, they've got to do what's necessary to have as little counterparty risk as possible, at least with the insurance side of their portfolio. And then just to do what you can to eliminate emotion. I think you and I have probably an inside track to that most people don't have because we have all the comments
in
our YouTube videos. And it's so obvious to me when people are getting overly emotional about something. And I'd love to hear your opinion on this. What I've noticed is I'll say something that's pretty darn straightforward in my video. And when I know a video hits a nerve with people that are really emotional about a topic, when a lot of the comments are kind of ad hominem attacks on something that I didn't even say. Like it's not even what I'm saying, but they're so worked up about it that they're just taking anything I say and spinning it into what they want to hear. You know what I mean? Have you experienced anything like that?
All the time, man. All the time. It's a lot of, and you know, working sales, I get this a lot. And so I try to be careful on a lot of times the way I phrase things, but customers in the audience hear what they want. Yeah. You know? They really do. And you might say something almost in jest and they'll take it as gospel. Like, you know, you believe it, you know? And I was like, well, I you know, or something. I get that quite a bit. However, like I try and like, you know, state things almost like being the devil's advocate. Like I almost try and draw it out of them sometimes, I feel. And I try to catch myself like, hey, don't do it too much, you know, but like I'm trying to get the conversation going. So when I get that stuff, sometimes I feel like I kind of deserve it, you know, a little bit. So I don't take it too personally.
I'm not saying I take it personally, and I think they should feel free to comment, say whatever they like or don't like. I'm just saying that I've noticed that I get a lot more of those comments when the topic is very emotional. And for me, from an investment standpoint, I like to invest in things where there's no emotion or people don't even know it exists. And the two examples I use are like, let's use GameStop as an example, and let's use cryptocurrency. That's a good one. Let's use cryptocurrency and let's use coal.
Okay.
Right. So when you talk about cryptocurrency, and I'm not talking about Bitcoin, I'm talking about, you know, all the little cryptos that people are trying to really speculate on, or you look at all the scammers on my videos who are going out there and single time comment to some scam guy, but trying to get you to invest in give them money for crypto. And that wouldn't work if people weren't overly emotional on the greed side, in my opinion, with these little cryptocurrencies, right? And you take that on the flip side and you look at coal. I don't have any scammers in my comments trying to convince people to give them money to invest in coal or uranium. You see what I'm saying? So my point is, I think the average Joe would be better served by maybe looking at the things that no one is talking about and people are not emotional about. It's not even on their radar. Does that make sense?
It does. Well, and you know, I think probably one of the most related kind of to that topic right there that I've experienced is just recently with the GameStop. I wasn't for it. Like the moment that I heard about it and I started reading some of the articles, I'm like, man, this is a pump and dump to scheme that I have, you know, unlike anything else. I talk silver to everybody I know, like saying, hey, looking for a place, silver. Over the course of the last week, I think I've had 5 different people tell me that they have bought GameStop. And I'm like, what in the world? Did you buy any silver? And they're like, no, but we're part of this Reddit thing. And we're on the move and we're doing. I said, guys, this is a total pump and dump. They are taking your money. This is not what you think. OK, this is a scam and you guys are going to lose all your money. They're like, oh, no, we got strong hands. We don't even anticipate getting our money back. And I was like, this is stupid. Don't do it. You know? Well, this morning I'm reading about how the Reddit retailers who invested in GameStop were very insignificant amount. It was all hedge funds versus hedge funds. This was a doggy thing. They were pawns in the scheme. And I just tried to say it, and I got so much flack from it. I have more dislikes on that video than so long, you know? And I'm like, guys, I was warning you. I even said, don't buy silver during this either, because if they're going to pump up silver too, it's just reminiscent of the crash JP Morgan buy silver that took place 10 years ago. And I talked about that story because I was all up on that. I'm like, yeah, let's do it, guys. 35, I'm holding on, you know, and then just to watch it go all the way back down to the teens. And I thought, man, all that money I put in, you know, during a time when I didn't have anything.
Yeah.
You know?
So people about that was my big concern too, man, is that people would just get super excited or super emotional about it, and they buy call options at $300, at $400. At, you know, I saw the price on the minute chart go up to $496, I think, when I was doing a video, and I'm like, listen, this, And the part that people spin, at least in my comments, is that if you say that you don't think this is a good way to attack Wall Street because you're actually just helping Wall Street, then all of a sudden they don't hear that. They just hear, well, George isn't with the cause, therefore he must favor J.P. Morgan and the banksters. You know, I thought you were for the average Joe, George. Now all of a sudden you're for the banksters. Like, no. Again, it's you're not hearing what I'm saying. You know, you might be hearing, but you're not listening. What I'm saying, it's just not a very prudent strategy, because all you're doing is okay, fine. You're going to take your $10,000 and you're going to put it out there to buy call options, and you're going to lose. Or, you know, you don't care if you lose all the money because it's about the cause. I get it. That's admirable. But you have to keep in mind, by doing that, it might make you feel good, but you're actually helping Wall Street, because that market maker's jacked up the price of those call options through implied volatility, to where if you do give him the money, you've almost got a bet where you can't win. Right. And I don't want to go into the implied volatility, but you haven't done anything. All you've done is given your $10,000 to someone else in Wall Street. And you might have hurt one hedge fund, but in the process, you've created all this volatility that's helped other hedge funds. One thing I said in my videos, you think the guys at JP Morgan on the trading desk aren't playing this volatility? I'm like, you're crazy. They're selling short at 496. They're buying back at 100. I mean, they're just making all these wrong. The market makers are making a killing on this because they're jacking up the prices of those options so much. And at the end of the day, when the dust settles, Wall Street on aggregate total will have made a lot of money on this, and the average Joe will have lost a lot of money. So I'm not saying the cause isn't just. I'm just saying the plan of attack isn't really prudent, and I don't think it's well thought through.
No. And then you also think about it, like, I mean, not just that, like, you know, the hedge funds, because, like, I don't know if you heard about AMC and that company Silver Lake, the private equity group that had bought a bunch of AMC, you know, through the leverage buyout or whatever they did back, you know, in 2000.
No, I know AMC, but I didn't hear about Silver Lake.
So the Silver Lake private equity group, I guess when the AMC, when the Reddit community, or not the Reddit community, but whenever this thing started pumping into AMC, I guess those guys cashed out for $731 billion, you know? I mean, $730 million, almost $1 billion worth on that.
Yeah, you know that I read this article that on GameStop that was saying that there was 9 individuals or entities on Wall Street that made a combined total of like $16 billion on GameStop in one day.
Right.
Just one day. And one of the top groups was BlackRock.
And this is what you get off of it. And now here's the thing about it is, it's like, okay, so now we got the truth of the matter. Is it's like, okay, so like, this is what really happened. Hedge funds, you know, some of them might've got hurt, but really Wall Street made the big killing off of it. But now you got the problem, reaction, solution. You got the problem. All this, you know, communities came in there. At least the narrative was, is that like through Robinhood apps and whatnot had, you know, screwed up Wall Street. Well, now are they going to start making regulations towards this? Are they going to start, you know, right?
Yeah, listen to what Elizabeth Warren is saying. I mean, I guarantee you.
Right. But that's the problem. They didn't do it. They said they did it, but they didn't do it. Right. But they're going to regulate them as if they did it. You see where I'm going at? You know, it was just like, it was a problem, reaction, solution. It fell right into it. Now, instead of having the actual ability to be able to do something like that, they're going to take it away as a limit. And they never even did it.
Yeah. In the name of to protect the little guy, it's like everything else. It's going to hurt the little guy in the long run.
Yeah. So I thought about this and I was like, this seems, it almost seems like it was a setup.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
Yeah, I wonder how many of those people or individuals with those accounts in the Reddit forums were true, you know, were just honest people that really are concerned about what's going on. And, you know, have principles, and I totally respect that. Or, you know, how many of them were just plants from other hedge funds that were in there just trying to manipulate the whole situation. I don't know. It's we'll see. You know, we'll see how it plays out. But I think what I tried to encourage people to think about in my videos is, yes, get pissed off at Wall Street. You should be pissed off at Wall Street. You should be pissed off at hedge funds. But but let's focus our anger at the real problem. And I don't think that the hedge fund, Melvin Capital or whatever, I don't think they in and of themselves are the real problem. I think the Fed and the government is the real problem, because again, it goes back to those interest rates. If the 10-year never got below 7%, to where it's not pushing all of this capital out the risk curve, you got to take more and more risk just to get that 7% return that you could have got with a 10-year treasury. Or shoot, let's take it back to the late 1800s. You could have got that in a savings account.
Yeah.
Or maybe not even that far back. You know, I'm probably, you know, I'm sure in the 80s and whatnot, and maybe into the 90s, you could have got 7% and maybe 4%, 5% real rate of return in a savings account. So if you could get 7% in a savings account, and a hedge fund could too, Wall Street could, pension funds could, would we see any of the mania that we've seen since 2000, when you include the housing bubble?
Well, no, but people wouldn't be driving nice cars either. You know, they wouldn't be driving all the new cars around and stuff.
That's
you know,
a great point. That's great. I
mean, you know, it's I love Peter Schiff when he talks about, like, you know, the two guys who meet. You know, he talks about the scenario. One of them's like, oh man, I got, like, you know, this new watch and all this stuff, and he's heavily in debt. And the other guy's like, well, all my stuff's paid for, but I got this regular old car kind of thing. You know, that's really, like, you know, kind of what you're saying there. It's just like, right. You know, I mean, I understand, like, I drive an old 99 Toyota, right? It has this damn headliner's falling off of it. $100 for this car. Now, I just watched a truck drive by. It was all lifted, and I'm looking at his tires and wheels, and they're beautiful. And I'm thinking, he probably paid $500 for just one tire and wheel there. Oh. And I bought the car for that. Yeah. And he's dumping money into that every month, and I'm dumping money into gold, silver, and Bitcoin. And okay, you know, I mean, everybody has their choices. I would love to be driving that truck, but I also like having a bunch of cash in my pocket. So the trade-off there. If you were to have that kind of mindset for everybody, then all the big, beautiful things that are out there right now probably wouldn't exist. And we would all be driving, like, kind of old, dumpier cars that we tried to fix instead of just throwing away and getting new ones, you know? There would be a completely different mindset that would be taking place.
Yeah, but would a lockdown have done as much economic damage?
Yeah, it wouldn't have. And I feel that, like, if somebody has good ideas now, instead of being drowned out by, you know, zombie corporations who only exist because they were able to get cheaper loans, you know, by able to sell their debt, they wouldn't be so, like, in competition, right? If these corporations, these other entities out there who typically wouldn't exist if it wasn't for the fact there's low interest rates, right, then these other people would have the ability to blossom and grow. You know, yeah, they could do something about it. But all this is just basically stifling entrepreneurship. And I mean, if you were in this condition, would you, I mean, outside of maybe getting the loan, but would you really want to face, like, competition against somebody who is just only existence is because they're able to sell their bonds?
I mean, to the Fed. at artificially low rates or artificially high. Yeah, exactly.
You know, so it's like it doesn't give any encouragement.
Yeah, and it forces, and it, then people get into this mindset from the entrepreneur, the mom and pop business, all the way down to the individual or the young kid that's just getting out of college, where the only way they can get ahead, because they can't compete with the Fed, let's say, they can't compete with what's going on, is just to speculate. Mm-hmm. And just take that STEMI check. And why not just buy call options with it? Because I'm broke anyway. I have no future. So what's the difference between having zero in my account this week and zero in my account next week, when I can take a flyer on these call options and I might make $100,000, and that really moves the needle.
Mm-hmm.
See, on the and I think that's the mindset that we've, not we, the central planners have created within our entire society. And I don't see that ending well.
Yeah, I don't either. I can't imagine what is going to be taking place here come, you know, the next year. I mean, I tried to, like, if you were to ask me 5 years ago how much longer the dollar is going to last, I probably would have said it was gone by now, you know. Like, sure. It's like, I always think these things are happening so much faster than they are, you know. Like, I learn about something, I'm like, oh man, this is taking place, this is going to happen. But these things, it's slow and it's drawn out and it's very grinding.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's ups and downs to it. So, like, if you're paying attention 1 week and you kind of take that thing and you're not paying attention to what happens next month, then you might still believe that things are heading in one direction when things have shifted, you know. And that's really difficult for, like, you know, the average person out there to try and, you know, say, what do they do? Like, people ask me all the time, where do I put my money? And I'm like, man, I don't even know what I'm supposed to do with my money. You know, there is no place. You're asking me what you should do. Yeah. So, like, I want to be a saver. Like, I've always tried to save my life, my whole life. Like, I always had, like, a stash of money, you know, I always saved. And there's no place to save. We just talked about that. The interest rates are so low, there's no realistic place to go to. And so I've had to, like, you know, start moving my money into, like, different places and consider it savings. That's why I have a stack of cash. I have my silver, and now I'm starting to focus in on Bitcoins. Yeah. And as I started doing this on a regular basis, and I do buy stocks. I mean, don't get me wrong. I have some mining shares I buy. I also buy into some ETF, you know, some market funds and stuff like that, just to be part of the game, you know. But buying these three, getting into these three particular directions, I've noticed that not at any one time does any of them go up or down together, and they kind of fluctuate away from each other. As gold and silver and maybe Bitcoin is rising, the dollar might be dropping a little bit. As those things are dropping, the dollar is starting to rise a little bit. So I found that if you have these three going on in somewhat, like, diversified kind of portfolio area, it's somewhat of a savings.
Right.
You know, and it's not exactly, because you're speculating the whole time. So it is a definite speculation, not a savings. A savings is something that, you know, you actually get a return on, like an investment. This is straight up speculation. But what I have followed, you know, putting just a little steady money into each one of these throughout the last 6, 7, 8 months, is that I'm actually getting a return. I'm growing. You know, the Bitcoin is very well. Silver has done very well during that time. The dollar has been dropping up until about 2 weeks ago, and now it's getting stronger. And you can see the buying opportunities that may start coming up in silver. So this is how I play the game. I just follow these three and just kind of put my money towards that. And then if I happen to find, you know, something out there that I think might be a reasonable stock, I may actually try and buy some. But
yeah. And I want to point out that you're not diversifying by just buying a portfolio of bonds and stocks. I'm blown away by people that think that's diversification. I don't know.
The portfolio, bonds and stocks, and then now you got cryptos, and now you got, so, you know. There's people out there who tell me that, you know, they are just, like, straight up into stocks and bonds. And I think, you know, all that is due in dollars. You know, all that is due.
Yeah, there you go.
Point. Anybody else can't get it all. You're not going to all get your portfolio, not at that price, you know.
What do you think about what's going on with Bitcoin? And my angle there is, long term, I'm bullish. I've said for a long time that I think the price could easily go to $100,000, and this was back when it was, you know, $4,000 or $5,000. I own Bitcoin, but my concern over the last, call it month or so, is that there's all that emotion that we were talking about with GameStop. I see that in Bitcoin online as well, and I would never sell for that reason. But I'm hesitant to buy more whenever I see everyone on one side of the boat, so to speak. You know, and I understand the general public doesn't have a clue what Bitcoin is and they don't own it. But I'm talking about just in the comments of my videos and more specifically on FinTwit. You know, you just, and on CNBC, I mean, it's just nonstop talking about Bitcoin. Every single time, Marshall, it's for Grayscale or, mm-hmm. or Bitcoin. And I'm like, you know, I you don't see any commercials on CNBC for coal.
Yeah. yeah, it's definitely one to put a cautious flag onto, as far as buying any significant amount of it. I cost price average on Bitcoin. I buy $50 a week.
Okay.
Sometimes I buy a little bit more of a typical, like if Litecoin was to drop, I like buying Litecoin. Like I like Charlie Lee. I like, you know, listening to him and the things that he has.
Interesting. Why do you like that one? Because I kind of usually single out Bitcoin and Ethereum. And mm-hmm. then I put the rest into a different category that we were talking about before that just, to me, seemed just wildly speculative, kind of like the dot-com mania. But maybe I'm wrong there, because I haven't researched anything other than Ethereum and Bitcoin. So why do you like that one?
Well, I think if you're getting into cryptocurrency, it's wildly speculative no matter what you do. So
right.
why Litecoin? There's a couple of them that I have focused in on. Litecoin is one. When I started doing research and I was listening to all these different people talking about cryptocurrencies and stuff, and I came across Charlie Lee, and I was listening to Charlie Lee talk about Litecoin and cryptocurrencies in general. And, you know, when I heard him say, like, you know, before you buy Litecoin, you should really try and get a hold of a Bitcoin, right? So he wasn't even like pumping his own coin. And then everybody gave him so much hell when, you know, Litecoin ran up to $400 or whatever, and he sold off all his Litecoin. They said, like, you know, he did like a pump and dump kind of thing. And I'm thinking, well, no, it was just a ride like everybody else. He might have been talking about his coin or whatever, but when it gets to $400 and you can cash out for $1 billion or however hundreds of millions of dollars he did, it would be pretty stupid not to do that. I did not blame him one little bit. And a lot of people did. And that's why they don't like him very much for it. And I was just like, well, that's not bad. That was a smart move. Don't blame him for that. And then I started listening to like the interviews that he was doing and stuff. And I just really liked his personality. I liked his understanding of cryptos. And it led me to believe that he truly wants to see cryptos become something that's a widely used mainstream thing.
Right.
I don't see him, like, you know, trying to make a bunch of money off of this, because he's already done that. Like it's all the money in the world is already in his pocket. He doesn't need to do this anymore, but yet he tries very hard. So I give him credit for that. And that's why I like standing behind Litecoin, because I feel that he is going to be pushing the projects that are really going to go out there and become part of the daily commerce. And I can only assume that if he is in the middle of that, then his coin would be too.
Yeah, right. Right.
So, you know, Litecoin. The other thing is that it's really cheap to use it. Like I buy computer services every once in a while. Like with Bitcoin, if you were to transfer Bitcoin, you have to pay a kind of a decent fee to it. Litecoin has like almost no fee. It's like really super cheap. So yeah. Like the nice, that has a nice feature to it. But that's why I like Litecoin. I buy Bitcoin just because I feel that it's going to be the digital gold, and all the rest of are a lesser of the true digital gold of Bitcoin. But then I also bought into something called Uniswap. And the only reason why I bought Uniswap is because one of the guys that I work with, he's an 80-year-old man, knows nothing about cryptocurrencies, absolutely nothing, has no clue, doesn't understand anything, came to me one day and he says, hey, have you ever heard of Uniswap? And I'm like, well, I see and seen it in the deals there, but no, I don't know anything about it. He says, well, I have some. And I'm like, how? How did you? Like, I'm thinking, no, you didn't, you know? He says, no, we did. We have this internet service that my neighbor has hooked me up with. And he says, the way that we do this payment system is using these cryptocurrencies. He says, I don't know anything about it, but I got this Ethereum wallet and I got an airdrop, a Uniswap, and it's worth thousands of dollars. And I went, holy moly, Brian, right on. And he said, so I sold half of it. And I was like, a real world case of cryptocurrencies. Interesting. Okay. So I went out and bought some, right? Just because I saw the real world experience take place right there and I wasn't looking for it, it showed up. And I was like, okay, interesting. So I went and bought $100 of that like 3 months ago, just so I would have some. It's like $650 today. You know, it's just like, holy moly, that stuff moves. Yeah. So kind of how I pick my cryptocurrencies, like there is a million coins out there that one could buy. And I couldn't tell you which one's going to end up being Amazon or if any of these things are going to make it, you know, or if they all just turn to zero. I couldn't tell you any of that stuff. But when I see real world experience taking place and something that nobody has any clue or even heard of yet, oh, yeah, you're in the early game. You know, that's the early game.
Yeah, that's it. So it's almost like you're angel investing in the specific cryptocurrency. How do you manage your portfolio as far as the overall construction? Meaning, what percentage do you allocate to these cryptocurrencies, whether it's Litecoin? I mean, I would assume that you've got some rules in place to where you're not like, oh my gosh, I love this new cryptocurrency. I'm going to go and take 90% of my net worth. I'm going to sell all my silver, sell all my Bitcoin, sell my gold to go into a Litecoin or whatever it is. I would assume there's some rules there, just like we were saying at the beginning for the average Joe, that they might be able to set up to where you are not emotional about it. You never want to be emotionally selling something because you're losing sleep. It's going down in price. You're checking the price every single 2 seconds on your phone. That's almost, that, as Jim Rogers says, that's a quick way to the poorhouse. So how do you personally set up your portfolio to make sure that you're not getting emotional?
I'm a saver. I'm a one-way street. It goes one way. I don't sell. So, you know, if it goes down, that was a bad choice, you know, but
how do you set up percentages though, right? Well, like, do you just say, okay, I'm only going to do 10% of my portfolio for the speculative assets, or is there a rationale?
Okay. So there is a rationale. I have a sporadic, but then I also have like, okay, so here's a set amount that I'm definitely going to do in this one particular direction. This much is going to go to stocks. And I have like a very small, it's like 30% goes to stocks.
Okay.
And then the rest of it, generally I'll try and do like either a silver purchase or a crypto purchase or saving cash. So okay. Now, because I look towards things that are unloved, unappreciated, and undesired. And when the dollar was getting so much abuse, when they were saying this is a trash item, it's going to be inflation, there's going to be no point to it, do not hold your cash. I like that. That's what I want to be cash. Okay. Yeah. So when everybody says they hate it, I love it. That's when I was. So lately, I've been trying to stack cash, but I'm anticipating that the cash is going to start moving up in price, meaning that the silver and cryptos are probably going to come down, like there'll be buying opportunities in there. Mm. So instead of stacking cash that day, I'll be going into silver. You see, so I don't have like a definite rule, but I do on some of it. So like I do the $50 a week in Bitcoin, and I do $50 a week towards that stock portfolio. And then that's like my set thing. And then the rest of it is kind of like the speculative thing. Like, where do I go? Do I hold the cash or do I buy silver or do I buy Bitcoin, more Bitcoin with it, or Litecoin or the Uniswap or whatever it is that I'm going to be interested in that day? That's kind of how I done it. I'm really naive when it comes to this stuff. I really don't know what I'm doing.
I think that's the way to do it. You just keep it simple.
I'm trying. You know, ultimately, I was trying to save because I wanted to buy some real estate and I thought real estate was going to come down. But now it's just like, I don't even want to look at it because it's so expensive. So it's just like, you know, I would like to think that, man, I'm saving up to buy this beautiful farm that I'll have to chickens and goats and stuff. And I'm like, but I'm not going to pay no $500 to do it. You know, and
so right.
I don't really even have any motivation on where I'm going with things. I just, you know, I'm just trying to build those things up for the next opportunity that may come. And I'd really like to see it happen in real estate, but I just don't see it happening as long as the interest rates stay low. And, yeah. You know, but it's only a matter of time. I mean, we can break it down. I don't know how much time you got, but like when we start getting into like the moratoriums that are out there, the interest rates, I mean, I have a feeling that we are going to start seeing interest rates rise. Like we're already starting to see it. Like the 10-year and longer maturity is going up and the shorter end is dropping. And that's like that widening of the steepening of the yield curve that's taking place right. I can only assume that at some point there, those interest rates are going to start dragging up the interest rates of loans out there as well. Now, the Federal Reserve, as long as they're buying those mortgage-backed securities, can keep the interest rates on mortgages low, but it's falsified. And at some point, when those moratoriums end and there starts to come foreclosures hitting the market, they're not going to just want to be willy-nilly and handing those things out to people just so they can all start again. They might, but I have a feeling that the investors out there are probably going to want a little bit more interest for their mortgage-backed securities, you know, to buy them.
Do you think the Fed's going to try to peg the yield curve on treasuries?
Yeah, but it's going to be a credible threat. It's going to be a credible threat. It's going to be much like the rest of the games that they play out there. Once they say it's like, okay, we got the 10 years moving too high or something like that, or they're going to try and, you know, I can't imagine them going out that far. They might, but, you know, if they say, hey, we can't have the 10-year go any farther than 1.1, that's it. We're going to lock it right there. Mm-hmm. The investors out there, I feel, would try to front run the Fed. They would be like, oh my gosh, they're going to go out there and start buying because they'll say it. We are going to buy as many 10-year treasuries as it takes to get the interest, to get the yield down to that point. You know, they will do it at any price. When the investors hear that, they are going to attempt to front run the Fed, right? So that they can buy these things up before the Federal Reserve has a chance to come in there and be the buyer.
So the Fed doesn't even have to do it.
Right. And then the Fed wouldn't have to do it at all. It's very much like what happened during, you know, just a few months ago when they came to the corporate debt, you know, when they had established that lending facility and they said, hey, we're going to start stepping into the corporate debt market. Yeah. They did a little bit. They stepped in there and people went, oh my gosh, look at what they're doing. This is crazy. Conspiracy stuff happening right here. And they all ran in there and tried to front run the Fed before they had a chance to buy the corporate debt. The Fed sat back there and said, good job, boys.
Exactly.
They didn't have to do anything except for get the credible threat out there to get the people to believe that that's what's going to happen. It's much like the inflation. Listen to the way they use the word inflation. They don't necessarily use the word inflation. They use the word inflation expectation. They want to make sure to get the inflation expectation out there because the inflation is already here. It's money and debt and the expansion of that. That's inflation. We already have it. What we don't have is that inflation expectation. And once the people believe that inflation expectation and they think that inflation is going to come, they're going to start behaving in a way that has inflation coming. And that's why you're seeing the long end of the treasury start to rise because they're demanding more for that long end. They don't want to give up their money for 10 years at a low interest. They want a higher interest and they're going to keep pushing that. Unfortunately, what that does is it pushes it down into the lower end, which is causing the lower end of the yield to start to drop right now. So there's an excessive amount of cash right now that's trying to find a place in the short term that isn't finding it. And it's just driving those yields on the lower end even farther down. Yeah. The Federal Reserve get to a point where they're going to have their Fed funds rate so close to zero that people are going to be like, you guys are losing control, yo. And they're going to be like, okay, we better do something. And they're going to have to start tightening up that money policy. Once they start tightening up the money policy, now you're going to see a real problem with the zombie corporations as their, you know, as their bonds start to go down in price that they sell them for.
The interest rate go up.
And they're going to start crashing like crash and burn.
Yeah. you touched on a lot of things there. One of the things was psychology. And I don't think that people truly give that enough weight. And we think that the Fed is coming out just printing money and bank reserves and printing, and that makes the stock market go up. Not really. You need enough. There's something else that has to happen. The Fed could print a quadrillion bank reserves. And it wouldn't do anything unless a third party, a primary dealer bank, a hedge fund, an individual took some sort of action. So it goes back to psychology. I don't know if you saw Snyder's video the other day he did with Emil Kalinowski. They talked about the panic of 1873. And what was interesting And you know, the data back there is all over the place. It's very hard to figure out. So they were trying to understand if the economy, the economic output was actually decreasing, and if unemployment was at excessive levels, or if it was more just kind of a media spin. So what they did is Massachusetts specifically hired this guy. His name was Carol D. Wright, to come in and start accumulating unemployment data and figure out how many people are actually unemployed and why are they unemployed. So that was the first kind of data a state government received. And then in 1885, the U.S. government, the federal government, hired him as the first labor commissioner, I think they called it. So they wanted to figure out, okay, well, if the economy is running, it's growing, but if it's not growing at 100% capacity, why is this? And he wrote several papers on this and unemployment, how that tied into GDP growth and whatnot. And the conclusion that he kept coming back to, it's all in the head. It's all in the head. The reason why we don't have these animal spirits that Keynes talked about decades later, and the reason why people aren't going out and taking risk, borrowing money, growing the economy, starting businesses, is because they've got this mindset of uncertainty. Mm-hmm. They don't know what's going to happen. And it goes right back to what you were talking about with the restaurant owners. Remember? Mm-hmm. They don't know what the hell it's going to be like tomorrow. They don't know the rules are going to change. So you're not going to have anyone take any risk. You're not going to have those animal spirits, which ironically is what we need for these Keynesian models to actually work. We need the animal spirits. But what they're doing to create the animal spirits is taking away from the animal spirits because it's creating more and more uncertainty. So I'd like to get your, I know I've kept you too long here, man. I'm sorry, but I'd love to get your feedback on how much of economic growth or a recession or a depression, or how much of that is just psychological, and what can we do to fix it? I mean, I totally am on the side with Snyder that it's all about certainty. You have to create certainty for entrepreneurs to take risk. And if you keep doing quantitative easing, if you keep on manhandling interest rates, if you keep doing stimulus and all of the and lockdowns, and then take it back and then do something else. You know, you lock down, unlock down, lock down, unlock down. You keep doing all these things. And I'm not going to sit here and argue about the health benefits. The bottom line is it creates uncertainty, which will create less economic output in the private sector, in my opinion. What do you think?
Yeah, well, you know, many times it's been said this whole thing is all based on confidence.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's ultimately what it comes down to. If people are fearful, they're not going to spend their money. If people are, you know, not fearful, they're going to spend their money. They're going to go out and enjoy themselves. With the condition of things that are out there right now, I just can't imagine that somebody is going to be like real inspired to go out there and like, say, start a restaurant or start something that would be typical of like what you would see an entrepreneur attempt to do.
Right.
That's a fearful state. You know, with that being said, that's like the perfect opportunity for people to get in, right? Because nobody else is doing it. So like, you know, it's kind of weird to think that, you know, during a time when everybody is kind of fearful is the time that you have to be the one that's like, you know, thrown into the wind, you know? You know, as far as fixing it or keeping, I just don't see any way that the system can be like a stable system. It's part of booms and bust cycles is just something you have to have. It's part of the system. It's part of like, you know, anything. It's like being, like I said, like being the farmer. You have harvests and you have, you know, and you have planting seasons. It's like they're two completely different realms, but you have to have both of them in order for it to work. And it's seasonal, you know, so you just keep cycling it through. When, you know, I think about that a lot because like when the garden is at its best, is just about the time you're about ready to make it look like hell. You know, that's when, you know, when everything is looking so good and everybody's talking about everything being awesome, that's when harvest season's about ready to come. It's, you know, it's a cycle, so it's going to spin. And when everything looks as horrible as it's going to be, well, this is the time that it's going to start going better. I mean, is it going to keep getting worse? Maybe, but at some point it's going to turn and things will be starting to get better. Happens through life with everything. I mean, it happens in a day. It can happen over the course of years. You know? So there is no fixing. There is no stability to it. The only thing you can do is try to understand what's happening at the time and to, you know, to be cautious of what you are doing when that time comes. It's kind of like being out there on that river. Right now it's really nice and calm. But we can be out there on the river tomorrow and it can be nasty, but the next day it'll be calm again. So being out there on the river every day, you're going to know how to deal with it no matter what's happening. Yeah. That's the thing. That's the same thing you have to be, you know, with economics. You can't just like go out there one day, say, yeah, I get this. I understand how it works. And then anticipate going out there during a storm and being able to function. You're not going to do it. You know, so you have to be there every day, learning every day what's going on.
Yeah,
because it's going to turn. There's nothing will stay the same. There is no stability. Yeah. It won't happen.
So the irony here is the uneducated economist is telling us to be educated in economics.
Watch my show. I don't know. I try to talk about it. Yeah, that's ultimately what it is. Everybody should be an economist. Everybody should be their own little uneducated economist, studying every day what is happening with interest rates, try to understand what, you know, the Fed funds rate are, what interest on excess reserves are, why, you know, what the repo market was all about. All these things, they're very complicated. But once you get it, once you understand what's going on there, man, does the whole thing seem so much clearer and easier to understand. I listen to politicians talk on TV and I am so confused. They talk about the economy and how things need to be and stuff. And I'm like, you guys are dipshits.
Yeah. You know?
I mean, I'm sorry, I don't mean to cuss on the show, but that's ultimately what it is. It's like, you guys don't talk to these people properly, you know? Yeah. I mean, and I know why. It's because if anybody ever truly understood how the monetary system worked, it would fail. So,
You know. Yeah, the politician is completely clueless. That's why it doesn't make it. It's just drivel. It's gibberish because they don't understand what's coming out of their mouth. They don't understand the words they're saying. They don't understand the concepts. But to better understand those concepts, you've got to go to the YouTube channel of this man. I keep tempted to say your first name there. We'll call him Mr. Economist. So how can we got to do this more often, man? I know, you know, I had all these things that I wanted to talk about, this list of items that I thought would be really interesting, but I just, whenever we talk, it's just more of a conversation between the two of us. Yeah. And to me, that's just so much more fun. So hopefully the viewers will get a kick out of it as well, because I just love talking to you, man. But for my viewers and listeners who want to find out more, go to your channel. How can they do that? Where can they go?
So I'm pretty active on YouTube. That's pretty much where the place I'm at. I do have like the other social medias, Twitter and Facebook and stuff like that. I've been so busy working on the website, though. That's really where
I got a website coming.
I have my website. I just fired it up last week. So it's brand new. I'm still working on it. Where it scrolls really easy. It loads very fast. So I'm putting like news articles there. I'm doing some of my own writings. You can find my videos there. You can contact me there. So I'm really encouraging people to try and find me over on the uneducatedeconomist.com site. That would be awesome. But yeah, YouTube is where I'm most active. Uneducated Economist on the YouTube channel. Post daily videos there. We have an excellent forum for conversations. I would really like to say that's where the gold of my channel is. I put out the topic, the conversation for everybody to discuss. And you go down there to the comments section, it's like pure gold down there. Yeah. And so I really appreciate everybody who comes to the channel, you know, leaves the thumbs up, you know, shares my stuff. But the comments is really, really what I'm looking for. That's where I think the gold of the channel is. So
yeah, for sure. You've done just an incredible job building that community. And the community is fantastic. So you got to check it out. So.
Yeah, but
I've kept you way long. You're probably late for work here. I'll let you go. Thanks for your time. I can't wait to do it again, man.
Thank you so much, George. I really appreciate it. We'll see you.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.
Yeah.